I'm Aaron Pednotti, and today I'm interviewing Jesus Papaleta Melendez, who goes by Papo, about a First Amendment case about public access television in New York City that he, along with others, is pursuing before the United States Supreme Court. Papo, thanks so much for joining us today on the Hudson Mohawk Magazine. I look forward to talking to you about your case.
Okay, thank you for having me, Aaron. Thank you.
So to start out, can you give us the basics on the case? What's it about, and who are the parties involved in bringing it to the Supreme Court?
Didi Halleck, who is a video pioneer in public access in terms of providing video to youth way back in the 60s when, you know, cameras were gigantic objects and stuff and nobody knew anything about video. And, you know, she worked with some kids at Otisville. So she has this long history. I know Didi from UCSD in San Diego, where I lived, and she was a professor at the university there, and I met her through some mutual friends, so I've known her since about 1992 or so. Then, you know, she retired and came to New York, and I also came back to New York to live here. I'm originally from East Harlem, and grew up in East Harlem in the 50s and went to California in the 80s, so that's how I know Didi. Me, I'm a poet. I'm a published poet. I've been an author since I was about 19 years old. I'm one of the original founders of the New Eurekan Movement, which is a movement of New Eurekans or Puerto Ricans who were either born in the United States or came here as children from Puerto Rico. And the reason why they're called New Eurekans is because the effect on their lives is more New York as an experience being Puerto Rican than being in Puerto Rico being a Puerto Rican. You know, we're sensitized by this society rather than our natural society because we were removed from it in either case. So what happened is that I've been involved with video production since I've known Didi Halleck, and Manhattan Neighborhood Network is the sole provider of public access in Manhattan. Each borough has its own public access service. And so what happened is that Manhattan Neighborhood Network used to function out of 57th Street and 10th Avenue facility over there for many, many years. But then they started migrating to El Barrio. First, they had a little annex here in the late 1990s, about 2000, 2002, somewhere around there. I'm not sure, but they showed up in El Barrio, and they promised that they were going to open up a center in El Barrio. But they started with their little satellite in which they offered classes to teach people how to work the equipment, take video. And eventually they had a program called the Community Media Program, where if you went through their training with a group of people, like let's say you formed some kind of consortium of people to do video, well, then they would grant you the equipment that you would need, a camera, a Mac computer, hard drive, microphones, and then you were, you know, then you were able to go out and do your own projects, film them, cam them, and take them over to Manhattan Neighborhood Network for broadcast. And, you know, there was never any money really involved. This is just all community activism, which was all good. But when they came to El Barrio, they opened up their Barrio Center, the media center, in an old firehouse that used to be next to the 23rd Precinct on 104th Street, between Lexington and 3rd Avenues in East Harlem. So they took over the firehouse and took it over. I don't know how they acquired it, but they acquired the firehouse and they rebuilt it, renovated it, and it really was a state-of-the-art video and broadcast facility in our community. And I was excited about it. I wanted to take classes and everything. Anyway, they hired Dan Copeland, the executive director, hired Iris Morales, who used to be on the Central Committee of the Young Lords Puerto Rican Political Party for the 70s. And I was excited also because she was an advocate, I thought, somewhat radical, and she was going to be the director. So I requested a meeting with her to discuss the future of the firehouse. But unbeknownst to me, the meeting that I had requested turned out to be an interview of me by her for a program that she was starting called the Community Leadership Program. And that program chose people from the community and they would be trained to use the equipment and blah, blah, and be able to provide video for MNN via community access and so forth. In the meanwhile, Didi Halleck was working with the committee, an ad hoc committee that wanted to reinstate the community art grants. and wanted the Committee of Media Grants and wanted to participate in an executive board meeting to bring up their case about the reinstatement of those funds, because while they cut those funds, they had given themselves raises to the point where Dan Coughlin is now making more than $255,000 a year to run a nonprofit in East Harlem. I have nothing to do with that. I don't really care about that, except that it seems that, you know, they took from Peter to pay Paul in terms of raising their salaries and eliminating a program for the community. So we challenged them on that, and eventually Dan Coughlin had permitted Didi, myself, and one other individual to attend a meeting. So we did when that meeting came up in March of, I believe it was 2012, and we went to the meeting, and Didi wanted to record the meeting, and feeling that she was in the right to do so according to the Roberts rules of board meetings for non-for-profit organizations, and they kicked us out of the meeting because Didi was recording and they didn't want her to record the meeting. So they adjourned the meeting rather abruptly and threw us out. So I went back upstairs to continue my classes that night for the community leadership program when Iris told me she wanted to talk to me, took me downstairs, yelled at me and everything, and basically kicked me off the program, except she didn't tell me. So the following Wednesday when I went to class, my name wasn't on the roster, and I couldn't get in the building or attend classes. When I questioned her about that, she told me to come in on Friday. We had a meeting, and at that meeting, she basically verbally attacked me again and threw some papers at me and cursed me out, called me a traitor. I don't know why. It got very, very ridiculous. So Didi and I tried to attend the grand opening, which was open to the public, except we were not allowed in to the facility at that time. Well, so we filmed that whole thing, and Didi edited it, and she aired it on MNN called the 1% Visit to Barrio, because we felt like the only people that were being allowed into the firehouse, what, you know, was commonly called the 1%, which the architects and designers and not people from the community per se. So when she aired the program, they took umbrage with it, and they claimed that I had spoken violently and threateningly to them about their workers and so forth. I was just merely frustrated and you know, chose some unfortunate language, but nothing that I wanted to do any harm to anyone. Anyway, they used that as an excuse down and not rebroadcast it. And so that's when Didi decided to sue. And she asked me if I would join her in that suit. And I said, yes. So we sued them in the Second Circuit in New York. And that was basically thrown out of court because it was like a donut. You know, the judge couldn't make a decision. It was like over his head, you know, out of his field. He dismissed the case without prejudice. I believe that's the term. And we appealed that to a tribunal from the Second Circuit. And we won that decision 2-1. And then they had to appeal, and they did this appeal to the whole appellate court, which I think refused to hear it, so they bumped it up to the Supreme Court. That's how we got there.
Okay, and I understand that the Koch brothers have a role in the amicus briefs for this case. Can you fill us in on that?
Well, yes, the Koch brothers and some other conservative and, I don't know, right-wing, whatever, were mainly interested in the case once we were moving up the ranks of courts. And they became very interested and wrote a lot of articles. Now, the interesting thing about their articles and the Cato group, I believe the Cato wrote one group not favoring either party. But basically, all these other organizations that wrote amicuses against us were trying to broaden the scope of the lawsuit. They were saying it's going to affect Twitter, Facebook, Instagram, all these other outside forces. But what people don't realize is that the contract that allows Manhattan Neighborhood Network to function as it does is one that they signed with Time Warner and the City of New York. And when they signed those contracts specifically state that that the service needs to be run on a first-come, first-served basis, which is what the court was really focusing on Monday at the hearing. is like, you know, what is first come, first serve? There was a big argument on that. First come, first serve, free, open to the public, and there's no editorial commentary possible. You know, you have to protect the First Amendment. So that's what the whole case is about. Can you be a private organization, accept funds to provide a service that you now have the monopoly on because nobody else can provide, not cable service, but public access via cable service, except Manhattan Neighborhood Network in Manhattan. In the Bronx, it's, you know, Cablevision, I believe, and Queens is their own, and Staten Island, you know, and Brooklyn, they all have different entities for their counties. But Manhattan Neighborhood Network is a big, big organization, and they say that they're a private entity and they have nothing to do with protecting the First Amendment, though they have this exclusive franchise. The city says it created a public forum just by granting them the franchising.
So what do you think your chances are at the Supreme Court, given the increasingly rightward tilt of the court after the appointments of Justices Gorsuch and Kavanaugh?
Kavanaugh was interesting. I was watching him. He was opposed to us. His thing was private property versus the First Amendment. As I, you know, I'm not a law person. You know, I just sat there and listened and tried to get what I could out of it. Very interesting. I don't know how many votes we have, maybe two. It might be tied 2-2, you know, it might be 3-2 in favor of petitioners, in this case being eminent. I don't know, really. It was really hard to read where anybody was going. The questions were quite poignant, but you still can't tell. You know, I don't know if somebody was asking something because they're interested in that or if they were asking it to advocate something else. You know, I don't know. I just sat there and listened to this battle. I believe the transcript is supposed to be released. It's a voice print, so I don't know if that happened yet. It's supposed to be today, Friday. We don't expect to hear from them till the earliest May, and probably June, with their decision. Okay. So I don't, you know, like I said, I'm at a loss. I hope we win because I think we're right. See, the thing is, at issue too, is that can the federal government shirk its responsibility to the First Amendment by delegating or creating forums where the First Amendment applies, but because it's being done with a private organization, it doesn't apply to them. You know, mm-hmm. And one of them was a prison organization that wrote an amicus on our behalf saying that, you know, if they hire outside sources and those outside sources begin to torture the prisoners, aren't they responsible for that?
This sounds like it relates to issues about public and private organizations becoming increasingly similar to each other, especially
yeah.
As we're dealing with the effects of 40 years of neoliberal economics.
Yeah, private rights are going to usurp the First Amendment. That's my feeling. I'm just a poet, you know, other than that, a lay person. I don't really, I'm impressed with the battle. I'm impressed with how much work goes into bringing up a case and defending it and then defending it against, you know, the attacks of the respondents, you know, whatever they are. The last amicus by Eminem had no curse word in it. It had no curse words in it, but it was cursing. I'll tell you that right now. I said, dang, because it was pretty good literature.
Well, we are out of time, so we're going to have to cut it short there. But thanks again for this interview, Papo, and very best of luck
to you
in your legal struggles moving forward.
Thank you very much. Thank you, Aaron.
Our pleasure.